and with that I'm a leaves. I sit down again and look at the palm tree, keeping my thoughts centered on this tree, nothing else. Hours go by and evening comes. I have to go home. Menu is waiting for me outside and we go home together. The next morning I am back in the temple garden, and after our group exercises I take my place again under the palm tree, concentrating on it. When I began this exercise, all kinds of extraneous thoughts disturbed me. I suddenly remembered what Menu had told me the evening before. I noticed a bird up in the fronds, then a gnat was humming about my ears, then I remembered Chancellor Ruka's impertinences and felt angry. But I chased away all foreign thoughts as they arose in me and concentrated only on the palm tree. Now I am getting along better. Thoughts can no longer reach me and really disturb me. Previously I was still in the world of thoughts, among the thoughts. My thoughts were able to push me to and fro. But I did not let myself be pushed around. I stayed put just where I was, with the palm tree, gliding slowly and almost imperceptibly further and further into myself where thoughts could no longer follow and disturb me. Now and again a thought bobs up, creeping through my intellect like a tired traveler. From my secure position I observe this stray, straggling, tired thought, but I don't bother about it. I think of the palm tree. Slowly the palm tree fills my entire being. Days go by, perhaps weeks too, I don't know. I don't know anything more that's going on in my outer world, as I am concentrating on the palm tree with all my attention. Then all of a sudden I have the odd feeling that I am no longer looking at the tree from the outside, but from the inside. To be sure I still perceive its outward form with my eyes, but I begin, to an ever-increasing extent, to see and experience the inner being, the animating creative principle of the palm. To see it. To experience it. To be it. And finally there comes a moment in which I am suddenly conscious of the fact that the palm is no longer outside myself, no exclamation mark, it never was outside, it was only a false conception on my part, the palm tree is in me and I in it, I myself am the palm tree. I do not know how long I have been thus absorbed within myself. I don't even know what time means. Therein the condition I am in, the concept of time is unknown. Neither can I explain what this there is. But all at once some power draws me back, slowly, into my personal consciousness, and I notice that I is standing before me. My eyes meet his gentle glance. He sits down near me in the soft grass, waits patiently till I come back to my senses, then looks at me questioningly. I make one or two attempts to speak, but I don't succeed right away. Speech seems to have become completely superfluous. Finally my activity reawakens and my will functions again. The nerves of my larynx set my vocal cords in motion, and I can produce sounds again. "Oh, Ima," I say earnestly, softly, and surprised at the sound of my own voice, "I have become the palm tree, or better, I've discovered that the palm tree was always I. Only I didn't realize it." Ima nods his angelically beautiful head and beams with joy. "You're making wonderful progress. I'm so glad, so glad. You're making faster progress than anyone has ever made in so short a time. If you pass all your other preparatory tests just as fast, you'll soon be ready for initiation." Joyously we look at each other in silence. As I look into his eyes, I feel even more deeply how pure a being Ima is and what tremendous strength he radiates. The air is purer wherever he is. Then he offers me his hand and we get up. It's time for me to go home. After I have retired for the night and am already lying on my bed, Menu kneels beside me on the floor and asks, "What are you doing now in the temple?" "We do exercises." "Tell me what kind of exercises?" In all seriousness I answer, "Well, my last exercise was to think so long about a palm tree that I finally discovered I myself am the palm tree." Menu looks at me in amazement. "What have you discovered? What are you?" she asks. "The palm tree," I repeat. "You, the palm tree?" she asks wide-eyed. "Yes, yes, Menu, but leave me in peace, I want to go to sleep. Then Menu begins to laugh so hard that she rolls around on the floor and tears stream down her cheeks. Ha ha ha, so you're a palm tree? Where is your trunk, and where are your leaves? Ha ha ha, so you're not a young girl anymore. Ha ha ha. At that I sit up in bed, offended in my pride, and answer with all the dignity at my command, please take note I'm not a young girl, but the representative of the queen. I am the wife of the pharaoh, do you understand? And if you're going to make fun of my exercises, I won't tell you anything more. At that Menu begins to cry. Covering my hands with kisses, she says through her tears, didn't I tell you it would be dangerous to be initiated? Who knows but what they may really cast a spell on you and turn you into a palm tree. You talk so strangely now. Watch out, please watch out. It would be good if the pharaoh knew what's happening. Drying her tears, Menu leaves my room with a worried look on her face. I remain alone with a very unpleasant feeling that I should not have talked to Menu about my deepest, most sacred experiences. The next day, Tahotep sends for me. I am to see him in the evening. He sits at his accustomed place in his little reception room. His glance is as deep as the sky is high. He knows everything. Come here, my little daughter, he says with a smile. I step up to him confidently. He takes my hands in his, smiles and asks, do you know what your next task is to be? Yes, father, I know, I reply. And what is it? To keep silence, I reply, smiling back at him confidently, despite my guilty feeling, because I know he does not condemn me. He nods. We understand each other. I don't need to apologize. He knows me better than I know myself, and he knows with absolute certainty that I wasn't acting malevolently when I spoke to Menu about sacred things far beyond her level of comprehension. I look into Tahotep's eyes. He sees me with all my imperfections, but he also sees my determination to learn to keep silence in the future. Then he gently strokes my hair. I bow and leave. Oh! How often am I to stand before him and have to confess that my tongue ran away from my brain? That I had failed again to be able to offer enough resistance to the basic urge for communication that has been planted in every human breast. But nevertheless, in time I do learn to be on guard against this power too. I learn to keep my urge for communication as carefully and thoroughly under control as my favorite lion, and through this constant self-observation, I gradually form the habit of listening inwardly, whenever I want to say something, to be sure I have authority to say it. Gradually I learn to keep my mouth shut except when I really have something to say. And I come to recognize two beings in myself, a personal ego which is often inclined to chatter, without control, purely for the sake of communicating and attracting attention to my person, and in the background of my consciousness a higher self which restrains my personal ego, telling it when and what it is to speak or do, and when it is to remain silent or passive. The important thing is to pay attention and obey the orders of this higher self. Merely to hear its commands is not enough, everybody does that. During this period of time, Ima gives me further exercises in concentration to do after the group exercises in the temple are over. We sit together in my favorite corner in the temple garden and Ima explains, you know now from experience what concentration is. But if you observe yourself during concentration, you will notice that in doing it you go through three phases, intellectual, emotional, and spiritual. All concentration begins with the intellectual phase. You direct your thoughts to the object of your concentration and consider what this object actually is. In this stage you are using your intellect because you want to clarify your thoughts and seek a completely satisfactory definition expressing fully and clearly the object of your concentration. As soon as you have found such a definition, your intellectual work is done, for you know now what this thing is. You don't need to reflect on it anymore, for when you know what something is, you don't cogitate about it anymore. Thinking is the bridge between ignorance and knowledge. When we know everything, like God, we will have no further need for thinking. God is omniscient. He himself is knowledge, and his knowledge is as perfect as a circle. What should he think about when he knows everything? Only the person who is obliged to expand his knowledge needs to think. This work of expanding knowledge consists of thinking. When your knowledge concerning the object of your concentration is complete, you make the transition from thinking to feeling. This is the second phase of concentration. Your consciousness projects outwardly through your nervous system all the characteristics of the object of your concentration, impressing them on your organs of sense, so you have the sensation of experiencing them. With every nerve and every drop of your blood you feel the object of your concentration and what it is like. When you have thoroughly experienced the object of your concentration in terms of thinking and feeling, you go on to the third phase, spiritual concentration. This means that in your consciousness you become identical with the object of concentration. You are no longer thinking about it, or feeling what and how it is, you are it. We call this a state of being. In this state you don't need to think about this thing anymore, nor to feel it, because you have become it yourself. In this condition, all your thoughts, all your feelings, all your words, all your deeds become manifestations of the object of your concentration. You experienced this with the palm tree, but you hadn't yet had any exercise in observing yourself during these three phases. To take another example, let's say you're sitting on the bank of a river and concentrating on the water. At first you reflect on what water is. You recall that water is a liquid made through the union of two gases. You know that it can be warm or cold, that if it gets cold enough it turns into a solid, that it has color and numerous other properties. And you think along these lines until your intellect has completely grasped what water is and means. That is all intellectual concentration. Then you get up and walk out into the water. Now you feel what water is and what it is like. You feel through direct sensation that water is liquid, that it flows about your body, and you feel its temperature without measuring it. You can splash about in the water, make little ripples or even big waves with your hands and arms. That is concentration in terms of feeling. In complete concentration, however, there comes the moment when you cease to be a being separated from water, you merge and coalesce with the water, you no longer have a human body, you have become water. Now you no longer need to think about water and its various properties. Neither do you need to feel what water is and what it is like. On the contrary, you are now water yourself. Complete concentration means becoming identical with the object of concentration, being it. In the two previous phases of concentration you were separated, whereas in this third and last phase, the condition of being, you experience complete unity, then as a consequence, complete understanding and complete recognition from within. Of course your body hasn't turned into water, but in your consciousness you experience this state. Watch the people around you. You'll notice some are constantly talking about love and goodness, wearing sweet smiles of smugness, and trying to show others on all possible occasions that they are loving and good. But only on the outside. They wear the mask of love and goodness. But when it comes to deeds, they reveal their selfishness, because they are selfishness. Another person may never talk about goodness and never think that he wants to be good, yet everything he thinks, says and does comes forth out of goodness, because he himself is goodness. A person doesn't think about what he is, nor does he feel it, simply because he is what he is. He doesn't need to speak about it, everything he thinks, says and does is the expression of what he is, the manifestation of his own being. Now comes the most difficult task of all, concentrate on yourself. First reflect and consider what you are, then feel what you are, and finally you must be what you are. For you to have become conscious here on earth, you have had to leave your true self and enter into your intellect and feelings. So far you have only been able to think and feel what you are, but you have never yet been able to be what you are. Observe the people around you and you will see that they are not their real selves. On the contrary, they are always identifying themselves with thoughts, feelings and roles they are playing here on earth. They have fallen out of their real selves and become pretenders, people living in a world of make-believe. Only in the eyes of very small children can you still see the sparkle, the light of real being. As its intellect awakens, the child begins to identify itself with its outward person, getting more and more removed from its divine, true self. And all the while the person, as we think about him, is only a mask through which the true self, the great invisible one, looks out at the world. The person cannot be more than an instrument for the manifestation of the self. But people get so attached to their mask that they cannot free themselves from it anymore. The true self is king and master, the person is only his servant. But the sons of men abandoned their self and, descending from the throne, identified themselves with their mask, with their person. They make a king out of the servant and separate themselves from their true being. They force their higher self into exile, into the unconscious. The intellect causes this separation, and by means of concentration exercises and a purposeful effort to become conscious and aware, the intellect can be an instrument by which we get out of this separation and back to our true self. In the past you have concentrated on various things. From now on, your one and only task is to concentrate on yourself, progressing through the three phases of concentration until you achieve complete identification with your own true self, until you really are yourself. It is your task to reach the state of being which can only be described, in the first person, as I am that I am. But watch out. It's not enough for you to think what you are, nor to feel what you are, you must be what you are in your own true inner self. That is your concentration task until your initiation. And so I enter the long period of my life in which I devote myself to these two tasks, learning to be my own true self, and learning to keep silence. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil. When I have progressed to the point where I have pretty well mastered the art of keeping silence, I stand before Tahotep again one evening, and he asks me, "What have you learned during your struggles to keep silent? Have you only learned the art of keeping silence?" "No, Father, that was simply impossible. While I was struggling with silence, I simultaneously had to struggle with speech. To the same extent that I have mastered silence, I have also mastered speech. This is because silence means not talking, and talking means not keeping silent. I wasn't able to separate these two things. I've discovered that silence and speech are two different sides of the same unit, like the two sides of a coin." "Right," says Tahotep. Then he gets up and leads me to one of the great white stone blocks of which the walls of the room are made. Pointing to the smooth, white surface of the stone, he asks, "What do you see on this white surface?" "Nothing," I reply. "And what could I draw on it?" "Everything." "Now," says Tahotep, "this nothing therefore contains everything. In this condition both together form a perfect unity. Within this unity something can only become recognizable if it becomes separate and distinct from unity. Now watch as I draw, with green paint, the form of a leaf on this surface. The form of the leaf was already there on this stone surface before I drew it, but you weren't able to recognize it, because the positive form of the leaf and the negative nature of the background were still at rest within each other. They were completely identical. The form of the leaf was not yet separated from the everything that is contained in this nothing. When the leaf appeared on the wall, it became separated from the everything, and therefore recognizable. And remember something very important, the fact that this leaf appears in green color means that it is left behind in the everything its form in the complementary color, in this case red, as its invisible, negative picture. Whatever you see as you look about you is only recognizable because it has separated itself from its complementary half and the latter has remained behind in the invisible, unmanifested state. You can achieve knowledge only through comparing the two sides, positive and negative, which have become separated from each other. As long as these two sides are together, resting high each other, you can't perceive or recognize anything. Observe the visible world. It is only recognizable because it has separated itself from the unity in which the nothing and the everything are still at rest within each other. In other words, It has separated itself from the absolute unity we call God. The things in the world about us are only recognizable because the positive appears separately from the negative and we can compare the two together. There can be no perception unless unity is split into two halves, one of them manifested and the other, its reflection and complementary half, unmanifested, so that both become recognizable through comparison. Now follow me. Tahotep leads me into another room where he places a little figurine on a large table before a white wall. Then he puts two little lamps behind the figurine, one to the right and the other to the left, in such a way that two shadows of the little statue appear on the wall. Then Tahotep picks up a transparent red disc and holds it in front of the lamp on the right. To my great surprise, I see the shadow to the right on the wall is red, while the one to the left is green. How is that, father of my soul? I ask in amazement. Think for a moment and you will find the explanation yourself, says Tahotep. I keep silent for a while and concentrate until I experience the solution. Then I explain. The statuette keeps back the red color as the red light is projected towards the wall, and allows only the complementary green color to appear on the wall. That's why the green shadow appears on the other side. On the other hand, the statuette holds back all the light from the other lamp, and so the shadow on this side of the wall appears to have turned red. Quite right, says Tahotep. You see, the two complementary colors cannot exist without each other, any more than keeping silent can exist without talking. Whatever you make manifest in the world of things about you, the complementary opposite stays behind in the unmanifested state. When you talk, the negative side of talking, keeping silent, stays behind, unmanifested. And when you keep silent, the positive side of keeping silent, talking, stays unmanifested. When a mountain is formed, its complementary half, a valley, must also be formed. How could a mountain be possible without a valley, or a valley without a mountain? Nothing can ever be manifested and made recognizable, unless its opposite, its complementary half, is simultaneously present unmanifested. When something positive is manifested, the negative remains unmanifested, and vice versa, when something negative is manifested, the positive is unmanifested. Wherever the one appears, its complementary half must also be present, even though in an unmanifested state. The two are bound together for all time and eternity. And so you see, the separation is really one in appearance only, because the two complementary halves, even when they are separated and have fallen out of the all unity, can never get away from each other. Inseparable divine unity therefore manifests itself always and everywhere, for even in this seeming separation, it continues to be active everywhere as the ever-present attractive force between positive and negative. Both positive and negative tend to return to their original state, divine unity. Even though something appears in the visible world, it cannot split itself off permanently from divine unity. Sometime, sooner or later, it will unite with its complementary half and return to divine unity. The inherent force dwelling in everything that exists and drawing every created form back into the original unity is what we call God. All creation, the visible world about us, is like a tree. On the right side it bears positive good fruit, and the left, negative bad fruit. But both sides belong to the same tree and come from the same unity. Both good and evil have arisen only through separation from unity, which itself is neither good nor evil but divine. Only through separation is it possible to achieve recognition and knowledge. Consequently, the recognizable world must consist of good and evil. If this were not so, it would not be recognizable and could not exist at all. The entire creation is the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. But the Creator, God, is not a half which has fallen out of unity, becomes separated from it and consequently recognizable. On the contrary, God is unity itself. He stands above all created forms which have fallen out of unity. Right within himself, he has perfect unity. He is the nothing out of which everything arises and manifests itself, but in him the nothing and everything make up a non-separated, divine unity. creation always means a half of the whole. The half which has fallen out of unity and which has become recognizable through comparisons, while its complementary half has remained behind, unmanifested. That's why you can never find and never recognize God, the Creator, in the world of creation, simply because God has no complementary half with which He could be compared. There is absolutely no possibility of comparing Him, and so there is no possibility of recognizing Him. You can only be God. Listen, my child, there is only one eternal being, only one God. In everything alive there lives this one single being, there lives this one single God. God is the indivisible unity, He is present everywhere, He fills the entire universe. The whole universe lives because God animates it with His own eternal being. Hence God is like a tree of life giving its own being to the created, recognizable world that has become separated from its complementary half, in other words, giving life to the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. This tree of the knowledge of good and evil, our created world, is only alive because the tree of life, God, instills His own life in its veins, lives in it. The material world is like a tree of death, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and the God dwelling within it is the tree of life living in everything that is created. God is one and only one. This one single God is the Self, the innermost being within all creatures. God is everywhere present, and since two things can't occupy the same space at the same time and nothing can displace God from any place in the universe, only one and the same God can be present everywhere as the Self in every created form. God is indivisible unity. All creatures, all plants, animals, man himself, all are fruits on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, all are alive because the vital flow from the tree of life streams through their veins, that is, because the tree of life lives within them. And that means in you too, little daughter! Your body is also a fruit on the tree of death, on the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, and has no life of its own. But within you there lives the tree of life, because yourself is also a little branch on God's great tree of life, and you are only alive because God is living as yourself within you and your body, keeping your person alive. By virtue of having been born into your body, you have become a recognizable being. You have separated your consciousness from the great all and nothing, from God, from your own true self. You have fallen out of the divine, paradisiacal, original state, in which all possibilities of manifestation, including all plants, all animals and man himself, are still within the all-embracing unity into the world of many forms and differentiations. You have become a manifestation, a created form. Consequently everything you are here on the earthly plane is only the recognizable half of unity, made up of good and evil. And since your consciousness has been placed in your body, you have awakened in this body. That is, your consciousness has become identical with the body. To eat of something is to become identical with it, for what you eat is what you will consist of, what you will be. Through identifying itself with your body, your consciousness has, symbolically, eaten of the fruits of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil and by the same token become subject to the kingdom of death. But now listen to the good news. Your body is the result of separation, it is only the visible half of your own true self. The other half has remained in the unmanifested, unconscious part of your being. By uniting these two complementary halves with each other, you can return to divine unity. It is impossible to experience this unity physically, that is, to make your invisible unconscious visible and physical also, and unite the two halves together. For one consciousness cannot animate two bodies. To try to experience unity in this way would mean death. By virtue of the very fact that the body has become visible and recognizable because it has separated itself from its complementary half, the reunion in this way would have to involve the death of the body. Nevertheless, you still can experience, in the body, this divine reunion with your complementary half, in a state of consciousness. You can expand your consciousness until you make the unconscious part of you completely conscious, until you consciously experience the unmanifested, invisible half of yourself, and in this way achieve divine unity in your consciousness.